Thanks very much, Colin. And I'm not going to mess around with any massive long introductions because, you know, there's no need. It gives me a huge amount of pleasure to introduce Clancy, who's come all the way from Los Angeles, California. Give him a warm welcome.
My name is Clancy Emmonsland. I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to be here this afternoon. Glad to be part of Intergroup Convention. I am active in service. I have been in Los Angeles. I've been a GSR and a DCM and on the area committee. And I sponsor the head of the Intergroup in Los Angeles. And I'm already tired just about doing all that. I want to say one thing to get off on a negative note. I always resent when the newcomer looks healthier than I do. Can't you at least have a black eye or something? Christ. Anyway, I've really enjoyed the day. I've enjoyed the meetings. I missed the Al-Anon meeting, I'm sorry to say, but I had someone release me afterwards. But I've been active a long time in AA. I've had some experiences that people... No matter how sincere you are, you can't ever have again. I mean, I sat and talked to Bill Wilson for an hour one time, and I had lunch with Lois Wilson, and I heard Ebby talk, the only talk he ever gave in a convention. And all of these things is all very nice, but really, they're just things. They don't help individuals with sobriety. Today, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, next year will be, for some of you who might be new, don't know this, it'll be 75 years since Bill and Dr. Bob got together. And every time there's a decimal anniversary, happens since when he's 70 years old, there's a kind of an undercurrent of, isn't it about time to change AA, to update it, to keep it more current with the world? There's three things that in the last few years people have been talking about, some people, that is, isn't it about time we got rid of this restriction that you have to be an alcoholic to be an AA. There's so many people on narcotics coming in and so many people on other drugs, and we sit here and say you have to be an alcoholic to be an AA. This is really not conducive to modern times. And another thing is, and they take exception to, is the Big Book. It's a nice book, good book, but it's written in 1930s style. It isn't to... modern, it isn't up to date, it isn't a cutting edge, can't hold attention of young people. And the last one, of course, despite what Colleen just read, is that we should get rid of anonymity. Maybe once upon a time it was necessary to protect people in 1938 or someplace, but not now, because now it's almost a mark of distinction to be an AA. We see these actors come out of treatment centers and say, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're so proud, and people clap, and it all sounds pretty good. And so I want to just talk about those three things and the reasons for them and what they mean. This idea that why would you have to be an alcoholic in this day and age? And the reason to understand that, you almost have to understand the nature of what the problem is here. You know, there are two types of alcoholics. We don't talk about them much, but there are two types. There's a type of alcoholic who drinks and has trouble, gets some beefs, but something happens that really threatens his security, and he quits, and he never drinks again. I know several people like that. There's the same type of alcoholic, if they have become addicted to alcohol, which we don't hear much about, but it's a very bad thing. We talk about drug addiction. Alcohol addiction is much more lethal than drug addiction. When you withdraw from a drug addiction, you get very sick. When you withdraw from an alcohol addiction, you many times die, smashing your head in the ground in convulsions. But these are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. And these people go there, they hear the nature of their problem, and they quit, and they never drink again. That's one type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic. By the way you measure them, they get in trouble, have beefs, and something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe somebody dies, or they lose a job, or they lose a family, and they quit. But they always drink again. and the same type of alcoholic come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit. But they always drink again. And this is the type of alcoholic that has puzzled mankind for 4,000 years, at least in written records, and probably longer than that. And no one's ever been able to find an answer to them. It's as though they don't care. At one time they thought they must be possessed by devils. They'd kill them. And they'd flog them and send them away and put them in hospitals and jails. And even there's never been an answer ever. When I was a little boy, I mean, I'm old, but I'm not 4,000 years old. But I was a little boy, there still was no answer to it. In my lifetime, there was no answer to alcoholism. And I didn't know it or didn't care when I was a little boy, but nobody knew an answer. There's something called the Keeley cure, where they made you sick. They put drugs in your alcohol and made you sick. Did you hear that noise? Whoever it is, you got gas on your stomach. In 1930, there was a very wealthy family in New York. And they had a son, 35 years old. He was a nice guy. They're grooming him to take over their company. But he had one problem. He would get terribly nervous sometimes. He gets an attack of nerves. And then he would drink alcohol and get drunk. And they couldn't understand it. He was a vestryman of the church, a good man, but he had these attacks of nerves. And so this family, although there was a depression on, they had plenty of money, they found the best psychiatrist in the world and made arrangements to send their son there. They wrote this man, Dr. Freud, and asked him if they would take his son, their son. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case. That's the first break we ever got. I mean, we'd all be sitting here drunk today saying, but I dreamt I was sober. So they went to his student, ex-student, Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung said, yes, send him, bring him to my hospital in Switzerland. So two guys brought Roland, Hazard was his name, to Switzerland. And Dr. Jung put him in the hospital. Worked with him every day for a year to break through the psychic barriers that was preventing him from living freely. And at the end of the year, he felt Roland. He said, I think you've got it together now. I think you're ready. I don't think you'll have these attacks again. Roland was very happy, went home, stopped in Paris. Some wealthy friends of his family had a dinner to celebrate his recovery, gave him a glass of wine, toasted him. And 3 days later, he was face down drunk again. And nobody could understand why. Because he hadn't been nervous this time. So they took him back to Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung refused to take him back. He said, why, doctor? He didn't mean any harm. He said, I know that. He said, but I realize now I misdiagnosed his case. I thought he had deep psychological problems I could help him with. But I see now that he is what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for his condition today at any cost, anywhere in the world. And that was in 1931, not all that long ago. And Roland, he said, what does this mean, doctor? The doctor says, Roland, what it means is you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. Bad news. He said, well, is there anything else, doctor, at all? I said, well, he said, I've seen in the literature, there have been a very few cases where there's been an involuntary psychological reversion. They call it some sort of a spiritual experience, but I've never seen one. He said, frankly, Roland, your chances of being hit by lightning are better than this involuntary retreat. And this really did old Roland in. He came home on the ship. He didn't stop for any banquets in Paris this time. And on that ship, apparently, he did something that we all have to do sooner or later if we're going to stay sober any length of time. Although he probably didn't know it. He surrendered to the fact that he was helpless and hopeless, had no solution. And he came back. And here he was, a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. He wasn't a bad man, But he thought, how do I get more spiritual? And there was an organization then that just by coincidence was at the height of his career. Let me tell you a little bit about that. If you're new, you might not know about this. In 1908, a minister in the state of Pennsylvania, Lutheran minister, felt that modern-day Christians were getting too soft. They didn't have the zeal to fight for their religion. Like in the first century, people gave their lives crucified upside down without denying their religion. And they fought for Christ and they fought for truth. And he started an organization of enthusiasm, he called it. And he called it the First Century Christian Association. And didn't get many takers. Who wants to be crucified upside down, I say. But after the First World War, he came to England. And somehow or other, the students at Oxford University really took it. They, oh, that's great. This is the big thing, in thing at Oxford. So much so, it became known as the Oxford Group. And after a couple of years, he brought it back to the United States, now under the aegis of the Oxford Group, which gave it a little more class. And it got to grow. By 1931 and 32, it was everywhere. And what it manifested itself is, as in personal people's homes around the country, in each city, the better type people would get together and discuss spiritual values and how they could help understand Christ and how we could become better people. And Roland saw that and thought, maybe I can do that and that'll help a while. Because he wrote later, I wanted to stay sober as long as I could, so when I died drunk, my parents would have a pleasant memory of me. And some years later, when he died drunk, his parents had a pleasant memory of him. But he went to this, and he flourished. He stayed sober. He was excited about it. Pretty soon, he was in charge of the companies, and his parents were so bright. Yes, Roland, you can run the company. You're doing well. And after 3 years, I guess, they said, Roland, you're working so well. Why don't you take a couple of weeks off and go up to our summer home in Vermont, where we used to go in the summertime, go up there and just relax for a while. I said, okay. And he arbitrarily chose a couple of weeks to go up there. And the interesting thing is, if he'd have gone a week later, we would not be here. Isn't that ironic? There's a lot of little funny things that happen in these early days. He got there, and one of his friends came over and said, gee, Roland, good to see you. You know, our friend, when we were kids, we all used to play together. Our friend, Ebby, he's really turned into a terrible drunk. And he's really in trouble. Could you talk to him? I know that you stopped drinking. He said, sure, I'll talk to him. Bring him over. And he talked to him, explained to him about the Oxford woman. He says, you have to find a power greater than yourself. I don't want to hear that religious crap. And away he went. They're playing our song. Yeah. And so I said, okay, Ebby, never mind. But the next week while he was there, Ebby ran his car into somebody's house and now was in jail. He was on strict probation and now he's going to the prison. And the kid comes to Roland again, says, Roland, talk to my dad. He's the judge, but he won't listen to me. But he'll listen to you because he knows your dad and he knows your family. And so Roland showed up in court since he happened to be there and said, you know, Judge, I know Ebby, and I used to drink too, but we have a way in New York to stop him called the Oxford Group. And if you release him to me, I'll take him. And the judge said, only because it's you. I would never do this with anyone else, but I know your father and I know your mother. And I know that you have used to be a drinker. So take him to New York. But if he comes back here, he's going to go to the penitentiary. So he took Ebby and back to the road to New York and put him in a downtown mission. Got him going to Oxford Group meetings. And Ebby wasn't thrilled about this, but it's better than Vermont penitentiary. And he went for a while. And he stayed sober. And after about, one of the things in the Oxford Group was, once you got involved in it, in 3 or 4 or 5 months, you had to testify. You had to go out to somebody and testify, which I found Jesus, and I want to tell you about it. And Roland said, well, Abby's time to testify. Roland said, I don't want to testify. I'd be embarrassed. He said, you want to go back to Vermont? No, I believe I'll testify. But he thought about this. Who could I testify to that I won't be humiliated? And he happened to think they still had another childhood friend from Vermont who was a bigger loser than Abby was. Bigger than all of them. Living off his wife, a mooch, can't get a job, drank himself to nowhere. So he looked up this friend of his, Bill Wilson, and found he was living in Brooklyn. So he made arrangements to go over there and testify to Bill. He said, he won't even remember it, so I'll be okay. So he went over there, and of course, in our book, we read Bill's story, and he talks about, and Abby came to the door looking very sharp and well. He said, gee, Abby, you look great. Well, I found religion. And that's just, oh, who cares? But I heard Abby talk at the International Convention in 1960. He added a little bit to the story. He sat down at the kitchen table with Bill and tried to tell him about the Oxford group, and Bill just drank as fast as he could. You know, that's really good, Abby. I bet you have a good time with Jesus, don't you? And this aggravated Abby. He hated to be put down by a drunk. So he came back 3 days later, and he had the Oxford group closer with him. Want to talk to you, Mr. Wilson, about the Oxford group. You don't understand. And Bill did what most of us would do, I guess. Got drunker than ever. Here's for you and the Oxford group. Get out of my house. But later he thought, maybe I misjudged him. So early in November, he decided to go over to the mission where Abby was and see him. But on the way over, he stopped and had a few drinks. So by the time he got there, he was drunk. Abby wasn't there, but he gave a little short sermon anyway, just to please everyone. Staggered off down the street. Wound up in the hospital that night. The doctor called his wife, said, Mrs. Wilson, I have some bad news for you. Your husband is back here in town hospital. The bad news is I don't think he has any trips left. This may be his last trip. He's in bad shape. And she just burst into tears, and she didn't know what to do. She called the mission where Abby was, said, go up there and talk to him, will you, please? He's very sick. So Abby took a couple of guys, went up to see him, said, Bill, you've got to find a power greater than yourself. And I don't want to hear that. That religion doesn't work. You know it and I know it. So they said, okay, and they went home. In the middle of the night, this drunken, broken man woke up and just in terror screamed out, if there's a God, show yourself! And he wrote later, suddenly the room was full of light. It appeared, and the wind seemed to be blowing through closed windows. And he thought, I'm going crazy. I am going insane. But he had this strange feeling, and then it all got dark again, and the wind stopped. He thought, I must have had a psychic breakdown. And the next morning, he told the doctor what happened. He said, do you think I had a breakdown, doctor? He said, no, I don't know what happened to you, Bill. But I'm looking at you. You look different. Whatever it is, you hang on to it. And so Bill came out of the hospital feeling different, and he went to the Oxford group, to Abby. He thought he had some calling to help drunks. Now you say, what's all this about Roland and Abby? What if he just had if he'd have just had the experience without those predecessors, the very few people ever had religious experiences like that thought they were church things and went off to work in the church and were never heard of again. But he got it somewhat confused with Abby and Roland and stopping drinking. And he went to the Oxford group, and for every day for months, you'd bring newcomers to meetings. And they were not there to help people stop drinking. They were to help talk about Jesus. And you'd bring some old smelly street drunk and sit down. I believe you're vomiting on my shoes, sir. And sometimes you'd take him home and let him stay overnight, and he just told him about God and Jesus and the Oxford group. And one morning he got up about 6 months later, and he noticed his wife, who had been a very chic young society girl, and they got married, now old before her time, with gray hair, and putting on her sweater, with a patch on the sleeve to go to work in a cheap department store basement and be abused by people because we had to have the money because Bill wasn't making any money. She had to pay the rent. And Bill had a wave of remorse. He said, "Lois, my God, you're going off to work today. The man I brought home last night got up early and stole the coffee pot. I guess he's going to sell it for wine. And everybody I've touched hasn't helped. I haven't helped anybody." He said, "I'm going to stop doing this right now. I'm done with helping out drinkers. I thought I had a calling to do it, but apparently I don't. I'm going to get a job if I have to get a job as a janitor. But I used to be a stockbroker, but I'll get a job doing something. And I'm not going to have you live like this." And that moment, our society had a thread about that big. We were hanging by that thread. And he said, "Lois, I'm so discouraged. Not one person has stayed sober." And she turned to him and changed the course of history. I had lunch with her maybe 35, 40 years ago in Connecticut. I said, "Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? What a remarkable answer. Changed the course of history." She said, "I don't know. It just seems so obvious." When he said, "Not one person has stayed sober," she said, "You did." And he said, "Oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You just go through life with it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah." So he kept trying to do it some more. But he went down to the doctor, to the town hospital. He said, "Doctor, I want so much to help these people. I know how they feel, but I can't help them." And the doctor says, "You know why? Because you're preaching religion to them. Religion doesn't keep people like you sober. Identification. Believing a man knows how you feel. Try that. Explain how you feel and why you drank." He said, "Well, I don't know how that can help, but I'll try it." And right then a guy came along and offered Bill finally one last chance as a job. He said, "You used to be a sharp guy, and I understand you're sober now. And we're putting together this deal out in Akron, Ohio, this company. I want you to go out there, and I want you to get the proxies, and then you'll become president of the company, Bill. But if you blow this, you'll never work in Wall Street again." He said, "Okay." And away he went, and it blew up in his face. Failed again. And now he, standing in a hotel in Akron, got $10 in his pocket. Either can he pay his hotel bill or buy a ticket back home, New York, have to come back and confess to everybody, "I failed again, I'm nothing." And as he wrote, he stood in that lobby, and over there was a little door. I stood in that lobby a few years ago to see what his feeling was like. Over the little door, there was a little sign over it, "Cocktails." And he knew, if I just had a couple of drinks, I could find a solution to this. We all know that feeling. And he started to walk towards her. And boy, your life and mine were ending. And out of the corner of his eye, saw some phones over there. And he remembered he told his friends in New York that he'd called somebody the Oxford Group before he drank. So he, you know, I don't know if you've been in small town hotels much, but at least in America, they use a bank of phones. Then overhead, the ministers, local ministers, and their phone numbers. So we called the first phone number. He said, "I'm a rum hound from New York. I need to talk to somebody in the Oxford Group." And the minister said, "I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me." And hung up. You think that's funny? You almost died there, kid. And he called the next number. Nobody answered. And he called the next number and nobody answered. Busy Saturday, I guess. And he called the next number. The guy said, I don't know anybody in the Oxford Group. Please, hang up. And I don't know about you, but I suspect if I were in that position, I might think, well, God damn it, I did what I said I'd do. I tried. Maybe if I just had a couple drinks. But he started to do that. And he saw the bottom name was a guy named Walter Tunk. He said, "That's what I'll call Walter Tunk. That'll be a good closer." And he called Walter Tunk and he said, "I'm a rum hound from New York and I got to talk to somebody in the Oxford Group." He said, "Funny you should call. I have a lady in my congregation who has a doctor who just admitted that he was a drinker and needs help. Maybe I can put you together with him." He said, wait in the phone booth. And he called this lady who was heiress to the U.S. rubber company fortune. And she said, yes, my doctor's, let me see if I can get a hold of him. And she called his house and got a hold of his wife. His wife said, well, the doctor can't talk. He's drunk laying on the floor. But we could do something tomorrow. So she called back and got the woman back, called Bill back. Just stop and think. If either of these people hadn't been home, we'd be all done. I mean, it's that tight. But since they both happened to be there, she told Bill how to come out to her house on the streetcar the next day, which happened to be Mother's Day. And she called Mrs. Smith and said, you bring your husband out to the doctor. So on Mother's Day 1935, Bill took the streetcar out, and Dr. Bob came out. You'd think the chairman would stay for the meeting, for Christ's sake. This is interesting. But the doctor was too sick to drive out, so he had his son, 16-year-old son, drive him, young Bob, they called him. I got to be a good friend of his later years. And he took pleasure in describing that trip out there. He said, my sister Sue was there, and I was driving, and my husband, my dad in the back, saying to my mother, he said, Ann, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that I drank. And I'll go talk to this man, because I've spoiled Mother's Day for you, and I'll go out there. But I'm only going to give him 10 minutes. I can't stand another damn sermon about my drinking. I can't stand another damn lecture. And okay, so they got out there. And pretty soon this doctor and this Bill went to a room for a 10-minute talk and came out 4 hours later. The doctor turned to his wife and said, Ann, I don't know how to tell you this. That's the first man I ever heard who seems to know how I feel and why I drink and what drinking does for me. He said, Bill, I know that you're planning on going back to New York, but could you stay with us a week or two? Maybe we could talk of some things. You've helped me so much. And Bill thought, let's see. I have no way to get home. Yes, I can stay. So he moved in with him. And every day they talked about the Oxford group and the spiritual values and the deep understanding you could gain and the life with Jesus and how enhanced sobriety. And after 2 weeks, the doctor said, Bill, this weekend in Atlantic City, they're holding the American Medical Association convention of all the doctors. I was there last year, and I got so drunk that they just laughed at me. And he said, I want to go this year and show them that I'm sober and doing good. And I want you to stay here with my wife and kids, and I'll be home in a few days. Okay. So away he went. And the next week on Tuesday morning, Mrs. Smith got a call at 6 o'clock in the morning. She said, I'm sorry, Mrs. Smith, but this is the doctor's nurse. They carried him off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And station agent knows me, so I came down and got him and got a cab driver. We got him on the floor of the office here. I'm so sorry. I know he was trying so hard, but he's passed out. And Mrs. Smith, oh, damn. Got Bill up and said, Bill, the doctor's drunk. Let's go down and get him. And they went down and got this drunken, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. We don't care how sorry you are. You've screwed up everything. Put him to bed. And sick and crying and miserable. And a couple of days later, he woke up. What day is it today? Thursday, Bill. Or Dr. Bob. Thursday. He said, oh, my God. I got to do a cancer surgery today. And I can't do it. Can't look at my hand. My God, they'll take my license. What'll I do? God. So they got him up and put him in the shower. Put him in a shower. Got him dressed. His new friend Bill bought him a couple drinks to steady his hand. And he went off to the hospital to try to do the surgery. He said, I'll be back about 1 o'clock. And they waited for him. 1 o'clock, he didn't come. 2 o'clock, didn't come. 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. Everybody knew, drunken son of a bitch is gone again. Came in about 6, totally sober, glowing. He said, for the day. I hit that operation, all right, but when I was doing that operation, it suddenly struck me. The Oxford group has been telling me I have to make amends to people I've harmed. And I thought it never meant that doctors wouldn't have to do that. But I've been all afternoon making amends to people, and I feel great. And that was June 10th, 1935. That's the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't know there was a birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. They just knew he was going to stay sober again. And they thought, what went wrong? And what went wrong, they decided, was this. What had kept Bill Wilson sober? Trying to help other drunks, not discussing spirituality. That was nice, but that didn't keep you sober. So they found a guy in the hospital where Dr. Bob had some connections with a nun up there, Sister Ignatia. She said, we have someone in here. They have him in for gastritis, but that's what the term they use. He's just a bad drunk. And he turned out to be a lawyer from Louisville, Kentucky, that had moved to Akron to get away from his drinking. Of course, didn't work at all. And they went to his wife and said, we'd like to talk to, his name was Bill too, Bill D, we'd like to talk to Bill about his drinking. So she went in, she said, Bill, I have a couple of men who want to talk to you about your drinking. He said, I'm not going to talk to anybody about my drinking. I'm sick of talking to people about my drinking. That's all I ever want to talk about is my drinking. To hell with them. But I heard him talk years ago, and he said, but she was a very strong woman. So I talked to them two fellas. And the darndest thing, they never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and their feelings. And I never heard anybody describe me like that. And I'm so impressed. I was stuck with them fellas, and he became number three. Then they got a few guys who weren't very interested. Just in passing, they got a young guy. The first young guy who was 31, I guess. And they thought, you can't be an alcoholic at 31. You know, the rest of us are all old guys, drunks. But if you've been drinking a lot, so you come with us and go to the Oxford group and try to talk to drunks. And of all things, he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. And she fell in love with him. And that's a great moment of AA history, although it wasn't an AA yet. But they brought us our first relationship. I don't know a word that sends a shiver down a sponsor's back worse than that word. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh, Jesus. So you got to get a little thing that says, uh-huh, and just put the phone on it and walk. Just, but I know I thought the last one was the one, but I see now. Oh, God, when I saw her walking out of detox this morning, I just knew. Well, they got married. They got married. Now, that sounds wonderful, doesn't it? That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, married a guy out of the nut house who I sponsored. He'd been sober about 7 years. And I was against it, but they didn't want to hear it from me. What's the old man know? All her sisters thought that it was right. I want to give you the absolute epitome of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle and marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. Well, anyway, they got married, and they said, you shouldn't have to go out on us in our runs all the time to the Oxford group and all these places. You stay home and take care of your new wife now, and you'll be okay. And so they were upset when he stayed home and too long and got drunk and died. Turned her against AA for 50 years. But it grew little by little. And most of us know the history of AA. In 19, Bill went back to New York, finally got a small group there, and they had a small group in Akron, and they got a little group in Los Angeles, and a little group in Houston, Texas. By 1938, they thought, they were still the Oxford group. They weren't Alcoholics Anonymous yet. They thought, what we should do is build hospitals. Then we can get all these drunks in the hospitals and help them. But how in the world, where are we going to get money to build a hospital? we'll write a book, and we'll make so much money off that book that we'll build hospitals. And he wrote this book. He talked to a lot of people. He talked to his own feelings, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. And he wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which we read from today, and didn't sell at all. Few members bought them, nobody else. Couldn't build a hospital with the $78 they took in. So they just continued on. In 1939, there's a magazine called Liberty Magazine that they ran a small article on. They made it sound like a church religion. And by 1940, they're starting to become better known. There was a magazine called the Saturday Evening Post. There was a guy there who was a specialist on uncovering corruption. He just won an award for uncovering corruption in the Philadelphia dock labor unions. And his next assignment, get into that new thing called AA and blow the whistle on them. Show us where they're corrupt. And he did. And he couldn't believe it. It all, everything was just the way they said it was. You went to St. Louis, you went to New Los Angeles. They're all working for nothing. They're doing things for help people. He said, I can't believe this. And he wrote this famous article in the 1941 March issue of the Saturday Evening Post that took the nation by storm. Because up to then, they'd never heard of anything that worked for drunks on a continuing basis. And they were flooded with letters from all over. And Bill Wilson would send them a book and send them a philosophy of AA and what they were trying to do, and on and on and on. And just that every state, every town seemed to have an AA group pretty soon. And it was really wonderful. And by 1943, AA was doing very well. And then Bill Wilson started getting letters. Our group doesn't meet anymore. Bill, take us off the mailing list. Some of the guys got arguments and fights and didn't want to go anymore. And little by little, one by one, the group started dying off. And Bill didn't know what to do. So at the end of 1944, he started the Grapevine as kind of a big tabloid. Because people, they'll remember this here together. But that didn't help much. 1945, AA was on the way to extinction. And a doctor in North Carolina wrote an article for the Grapevine and sent to Bill and said, you know about this, Bill? And Bill read it and he was staggered. Just exactly 100 years before that, in 1840, there had been 6 drunks. One had just got out of jail again, went back to his friends and said, God, that damn chaplain said he knows how I feel. He doesn't know how I feel. You guys, the only guys know how I feel, but you drink as bad as I do. How can you help me? They said, maybe we can help each other. So they drew up a little statement, elected officers, 5 officers, 1 member. Who do you identify with? And everybody laughed at him. You drunks can't take care of yourself. You're going to help each other stay sober. Ha, 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 ha. But they somehow began working, talking about. And they stayed sober, and a few more guys joined them. And some guys came down from Philadelphia and started a group in Philadelphia. And a group came from Washington, D.C. and started a group there. And in a few months, they were doing better than they ever thought. And they realized nobody's ever heard of drunks helping drunks before. And so we should have a name. And so they named themselves after Washington, George Washington, because nobody ever heard of a guy, what he did, start a new country together. At the end of the first year, they had what they figured maybe about 350 members. And they're all staying sober, most of them, I guess. The second year, they got a couple of guys in the group who were great orators. They'd go out and give talks to large groups of people, which was the entertainment in the 1840s. There were no movies or television. They'd have lectures. And they started to get people just pouring in. Because nobody had ever heard of drunks staying sober like this before. Nobody ever heard of drunks talking to drunks. And by the end of 1842, they had a lot of chapters. By 1845, now can you imagine this, their membership, as far as they could estimate, was about 100,000 sober drunkards. And that might not impress you, but you stop and think AA after 5 years didn't have 1,000. With radios and telephones and everything else. They just had nothing except one-to-one. And in 1845, their leadership got together and thought about some things which seemed to make sense today to some people. They said, gee, we're able to help drunkards really well. Maybe we should focus our attention on helping other people. Maybe people who take narcotics, not heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium, and who aren't alcoholics, drunkards. Maybe we should get involved in social work. Maybe we should try to work against slavery. Maybe we should, all sorts of things. Everybody got involved in good projects and helping people out in the world. And by 1848, 3 years later, the Washingtonians were extinct and all of them got died drunk, with a very few exceptions. I had a book home written in 1861 by one of the few survivors. He said, I don't know what happened. We were doing so well and we were helping people, and then we decided to help other kinds of people, and nobody wanted to go to the meetings anymore. Nobody had time to help a drunkard anymore. And one by one, they just got drunk. And Bill Wilson read this and was thunderstruck. And he read how they fought amongst themselves, the Washingtonians, and how they fought over prestige and money, and how they fought over who was important and who could do the most. And he went to the library and got a book on the Washingtonians. And in 1945, in a last gasp effort to save Alcoholics Anonymous, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions, hoping against hope that they would help, because he drew as much from the Washingtonians as he did, but he was hearing the same things from his people that they were talked about in the Washingtonians. And he wrote them in the long form. Maybe you're new, you've not heard of the long form. But in the back of the book, across in the short form, which we have here on one of these things, there's the long form. And it's written, they're written out. They explain what they mean. These are just kind of created as a, to make a quick understanding of them. And he issued them one by one in the grapevine. And unfortunately, AA had a problem then, and it has it now, and we don't know how to overcome it. It's full of alcoholics. And most of them said, we don't want any laws. We're here for love. Don't give us the goddamn laws. And people refused to even read the tradition, wouldn't pay attention to them. And Bill was trying to plead with them. You may have read about it, maybe you haven't. But he put his wife in a sidecar of his motorcycle and traveled to missions, to meetings all over the East Coast, trying to explain, these are not rules, these are ways to save AA. But there's still a lot of problems. And so, in 1949, Bill and Dr. Bob, their followers didn't get along very well, but they always got along well. They said, if we could just have a meeting somewhere and get the people from Louisiana and the people from Los Angeles and the people from Chicago, all these people who don't understand, maybe we could explain it to them. So they found a place in Cleveland, Ohio. And in July of 1950, the largest group of sober alcoholics in history up to that time sat in one room. And a one-time affair. And even then, they were kind of, they had mostly non-alcoholic speakers because they wanted people to think they were doing better. But they had Bill and Dr. Bob each gave a talk. And that was an interesting moment because Dr. Bob was dying from cancer at this time. They said, Bob, you probably don't want to talk. He said, I've got to talk. I've got the second longest sobriety in the world. I've got 15 years. And he was a much more active 12-stepper than Bill had been. So that day, his son on one side and a friend on the other, tall, gaunt, sick, dying man, came to the podium. And I have the tapes of his talk. They're touching. He said, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope you'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we all do the same things. We all do come here and try to find the same answers. We try to do the same. We get out of AA what we put into it. He says, As I look over this crowd today, I'm happy that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. He said, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the last few months. My health has returned the way. You know, just talk. But then, he said, but I want to call your attention to two or three things that I think may be of interest. And then he gave what many people feel to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. because he was a great conveyor of the program, and he knew he was dying, and he wouldn't have a chance to do it. So he wanted to put it out there. And he said, and I quote him specifically, he said, "First, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly," he said, "let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. We're all full of love when things are going our way. Hey, baby. But let somebody hurt our feelings. Somebody put us down, say something back. And finally," he said, "none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, maybe take us to a few meetings, give us a pat on the back when we needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we are too busy to help our fellow alcoholic who still suffers in despair." He said, "thank you," and sat down and was dead shortly thereafter that. But that is as true, what he talked about that day is as true today in England as it was that day in Cleveland, or it is always, because that's the name of the story here. And then they had six young guys. I don't know who they were. But on the tape, they sound just like they're so excited, like their tails are wagging. They each took two traditions to explain, these are not rules. We can't even enforce them. This is not rules. We can't drive you out of A if you break them. It's for your own benefit. We don't have AA police. We try to do this voluntarily. And that sounds very nice, except some of us old-timers think he overshot. Maybe we should have AA police. In my home group, because I've been active a long time and I have strong opinions, they claim I'm a dictator. I'm not at all. I just tell people what to do. But when people get upset about that, they forget to remember an AA dictatorship relies on the absolute approval of the dictatee. All he has to say is, "screw you," and the dictatorship is over. It would be nice if we had police who came at night and said, "did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp." You know. But at that convention, they introduced the 12 traditions, and they were accepted, and they saved AA. And now we take them so much for granted, we hardly even pay any attention to them in a lot of places. But I'll tell you, they are explicit and so strong. And AA grew then, and it grown to 134 countries, millions of sober people that never happened before. But when you think about it, there's one thing that is holds true all the way down. The thing that made AA work, when nothing else worked, when religion didn't work, when psychiatry didn't work, when medicine didn't work, because it was people identifying with someone else. And that identification is what makes AA work. We all have had enough advice to last us 10,000 years. People like us, everybody gives us advice. "Have you tried going to a doctor? Have you had passersby? Think you ought to go to rehab?" You know. On and on. And you just shine them on. But if you hear someone that seems to understand how you feel, goes right in there. "My God, this guy knows how I feel. How can that be?" I remember having that feeling about my friend Bob. I had never known anyone that I ever felt knew how I felt. And as a result of that, I began doing things he told me that I would never do for my father or my doctor or my psychiatrist. And little by little, and that identification, that sense of one-to-one is what has made AA work. And that is why a friend of mine named Jim Willis in 1958 was a drinker, AA member, but he was also a compulsive gambler. And he'd bring his compulsive gambler friends to AA meetings because it was working so well for him, they thought maybe it'd work for them. He said, "We're not juicers. We don't want to hear that crap." And so he wrote to New York and became the first one to get permission to use the 12 steps outside of AA. And he founded Gamblers Anonymous. Same steps, but now there's identification for gambler to gambler. Then the next year, some narcotics addicts, friends in North Hollywood, wrote and got permission to use the 12 steps and founded Narcotics Anonymous because their narcotic friends couldn't stay sober in AA. Then a couple of years later, out in the west side of LA, some people founded Cocaine Anonymous. And then in mid-Wiltshire, a woman founded Overeaters Anonymous. These are the big four of the non... And all of them follow the same premise we do, except they allow the members there to identify. I didn't really understand that until I was about 2 years sober. And this was about 1960, I guess. And I was I've been sober for the first time in all these years. I'm feeling good. I'm enthusiastic. And I was giving a talk at the club on obsessions. Not how to get over them. I didn't know that, but I knew about the obsessions. And I had no frontish. And I weighed about 125 pounds. And this afterwards, this rather plump lady came up to me. She said, "That was wonderful. I think I understand what you're talking about. Many of our ladies would." She said, "I've just founded an organization called Overeaters Anonymous. Would you come and give that talk to our ladies on Sunday?" I said, "Sure." Give them something to shoot for. Looked like a skeleton. So I went over to this place and I walked in there, and about eight kind of fat ladies sitting around a table. And I gave them a talk on obsessions, and they really, And I got done. I thought, really, I'm glad I helped these ladies. I can do it. But then they begin having a little sharing session. And this woman over here, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. She had a son who just turned 10. He's in a military school in Long Beach. She sent her husband down to pick about an hour. And she got out the cake that they had. She thought, I wonder if he lemon like he likes. Took a bite and another little bite. Before they got back, she'd eaten the whole cake. And she felt so bad. And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I wanted to say, just have a piece of cake for Christ's sake and stop. You know, what's wrong with you? Woman over here said, "I just eat ice cream. You know, I love it so much. I don't know why, but my husband goes to work and I go to the store and get even more ice cream. And he ridicules me for eating it. But I love it so much. I need it to feel good psychologically." And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I wanted to say, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. Anybody be fat eating ice cream like that? But the worst one was over here. This woman ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she put her finger down her throat and vomited it up so she could eat some more. And I didn't say anything. I'm a nice guy. But I wanted to say, don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting. Your slimy finger in my hand. You know? Now, what is the difference? I understood intellectually perfectly what they were talking about. But food did not do that for me, what it did for them. So it just seemed to be weird behavior. And that's what you've got to remember sometimes when you're trying to explain alcoholism to your family. They want to understand, but they can't really. You mean you can't even have a glass of wine at Christmas? And they don't mean any harm by it. But that's why identification is such an important thing. And that is why, I suppose, I'm sure it is, why Alcoholics Anonymous to this day says, we want you to be an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about alcoholism, because that's the unique thing we have here to talk about. You can be an alcoholic and I'm an alcoholic and a narcotics addict, alcoholic and a overeater, alcoholic and a cocaine user, alcoholic, twist baby chickens' necks for all we care. But you must be an alcoholic. And the other thing to remember is this. When you stand at the podium, we don't care what your ANDA is. I'm an alcoholic, period. Just like in Narcotics Anonymous, they don't want you to say I'm an addict and an alcoholic. We don't give a shit about that. It's alcoholic. And talk about drinking. Today it seems to be kind of slick in some circles to talk about how much drugs you took. And I know there's a lot of people taking a lot of drugs. But you have to find a way to encapsulate it a little bit. And I also took drugs in that period where I did this, that. Because you talking about shooting up and sniffing up for an hour isn't going to help any poor sick alcoholic sitting back there to identify. I have three daughters, I just told you, I said last night, that turned 20 in Alcoholics Anonymous this year. I have a grandson that's got a year's sobriety. I have two great-grandsons, one of which is either an alcoholic or the spawn of the devil. I look at his little neck to see there's a 666. You set something down, say goodbye to it, because you'll never see it again in this world. But if that little shit's an alcoholic, I want him someday to come to these doors and hear people make him feel he understands. Not some gobbledygook or some sociological nonsense or pseudo-psychiatric insights, but just, I used to drink and here's why. And here's what it did for me. And if you're like me, you should stay here. So, that is why we do want to change. Be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. The second thing, I won't talk so long on this one, but it's an interesting one. They want to change the book. 1970, there was a movement in the World Service Conference to change the book. And why not? You know, the book is kind of overrated. I know when I first got sober, you hear these old fools say things like, this book is a miracle. Oh, Jesus. You know, miracle is a cheap word in AA. A few years ago, I heard this guy get up and say, I got up early this morning, and I looked at the eastern sky, and the sun was rising. And I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day of wonderful sobriety. And you, oh, man, come on, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, you old jerk, you know. Miracles are supposed to be things that are unexplainable or inexplicable, to be perfectly correct. And what's so unexplainable about that book? Well, there are several things, actually. First of all, he didn't know enough to write it. He had no background in psychology or abnormal psychology or medicine, surrounded mostly by people who were failing. In fact, interesting little thing, in the first printing of the book, he put those stories in the back. Most of those people drank again. Not because they were bad or malicious, I think, is my opinion, that at that time they didn't know that it continued. They thought it was like pneumonia. You get over it and you're all right. But it turned out it wasn't. But surrounded by failures, and he wrote this book, he wrote about things that he hadn't experienced. We talk about the 12 promises. He hadn't experienced those things yet. Where the hell did that come from? And yet, if you stay here, you experience every one of them. They don't last very long because I'm a little headstrong. Remember my children returned to me when I was about 5 years sober. And all of a sudden, I took hemorrhaging money. And I called up my sponsor at that time, a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. I said, Chuck, you know, I believe in the program, but God damn it, in the 12 promises, it says financial insecurity will leave you, and I'm in deep trouble. He said, no, son. He said, fear of financial insecurity will leave you. I punished him. I didn't call him for 3 days. But that's the worst thing you can do, you know, it's just deny someone your presence. What a terrible thing. But all these things, and he wrote this book, and 3 years sober. Just stop and think about that. If you're new today, you might think, boy, by the time you get 3 years sober, you should know enough to write a book by then. But you don't. By the time you're, you know, by the time you stay around, by the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Hang in there, Jimmy, you're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. You know, Is that two creams and one sugar, or two sugars and one cream? Never mind, I'll get it myself. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Where'd that guy go? This guy, 3 years sober, surrounded by failure, no background in anything, and barely staying sober himself, wrote a book that has changed more alcoholics of our type in the last 69 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. You know what that is? That's a miracle. And that's why we don't want to change that book. People want to change the book. What part of it don't you like? You know, well, it isn't written. It's not written as a novel. It's written as a... I'll tell you what the big book really is to me. It's like an emotional cookbook. You get recipes in there, and if you follow them, you feel better. And some people really, they study the book and read those and memorize them and have a terrible life. It's just like, it's like studying a cookbook and memorizing it. I know every M, why am I starving to death? Yeah. You got to cook the meals, boo. Are you handicapped? Come up here, I'll heal you. Well, she was young and blonde. I thought she might go for it, you know. In the name of Bill and Dr. Bob. Tonight she'll be tap dancing for us. But the book is written as a series of, with stories and why it happened. But the basic thing is, here's what you do at this next stage of your development. And it works. And as I said last night, I always ridiculed it, but I came to believe in it. That's the only book I know that gets smarter every year you stay sober. It gets smarter. Geez, that wasn't there last year. What the hell is this? I just finished in August. I read the big chapter. We have a big book meeting. And the leader reads a chapter, and then they break down in small groups of eight or something, and they discuss what they heard. And I read that. I've been reading that in August for 34 years at that thing. And it always amazes to me when I read it. There's always something in there I don't remember. And it's logical, and it makes sense if you read it. But when you skim it, you don't do it. But when you read out loud, you got to read every word, and it makes sense. But whenever someone tells me about changing the book, and I say, they started to do it in 1970, and they were outvoted, or 2005, and they were outvoted, but they, at least they changed the stories and changed the cover. But they weren't allowed to change the 164 pages. I hope they never will be, because I would hate to think that my great-grandson's going to have to read something made up by somebody who's been sober 28 minutes who thinks he doesn't like the language in there. You show me what you got and show me that's working better, and then I'll fight for it, but not till then. So I don't think there's any argument about changing the book. Change the stories if you want to, but that book keeps people like you and me sober, as it is. And the last thing is anonymity. A lot of heat on anonymity. Oh, I want to say one more thing about this. I forgot, because this is something in... One of the things that's most troublesome in AA today about non-alcoholics being part of AA and taking part in AA is that third tradition. Which side is the tradition on? Okay, I knew that. The third tradition says the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And these people show up and say, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm an addict. But I have a desire to stop drinking. I can be a member if I want to. I'm an alcoholic. I'll take part in everything. I'm not an alcoholic, but I'm an overeater. I gamble. I steal. But I have a desire to stop drinking. How do you stop people like that? That's what it says. So then you have to go back and read the long form of the tradition from which it was consolidated. And that clearly says we want to help all those who suffer from alcoholism. They never dreamed when they condensed them that someday non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. Gosh, you can't get alcoholics in. Why would non-alcoholics want to go? But that's something, if you remember, you hear that crap in your home group, just point out the long form of the tradition. But anonymity, it doesn't seem, you know, maybe one time, 1938 or 40, when people were skulking around, ashamed of being an alcoholic. They'd take the cover off the big book and put it on backwards, so just plain paper, so people didn't know what they were reading. And why would it be important now? And it's a funny thing. As the time went by, they realized, one little by little, it really isn't there for protection. It may have been once, but it's evolved into a spiritual principle. In fact, when Bill Wilson was dying in 1970, the last letter he wrote was maintaining anonymity, spiritual concept. And I didn't ever understand that. I know when I was first got sober in 1958, there was a very famous singer named, her name, anybody remember? I don't remember her name anyway. Huh? No. I know it so well, but I'm goofy. I've been in England too long. Lillian Roth. And she wrote a book, an autobiography. And she wrote a long thing in her about how she joined AA. And her sponsor said, "Don't do that, Lillian. It's against the tradition." She said, "When people discover that I'm a member of AA, they'll want to come here." And 2 years later, when she lay face down in her own vomit in Palm Springs, vomiting up her booze and pills, I don't suppose anybody gave a damn anyway. It didn't hurt AA, but it hurt her. The next year, 1959, John Barrymore's daughter, Diana Barrymore, wrote a book called Too Much Too Soon. And she took it a step further. She'd gone to AA, and it had helped her be able to drink wine with dinner. And about a year after that, when she died in the Malibu drunk tank, I don't know what people thought about that. But again and again and again, when people break their anonymity, I don't mean they all get drunk and die, but something bad happens. I've never seen anybody profit from breaking their anonymity. Now, why would that be? I'm certainly God isn't up there saying, "Oh, that woman broke her anonymity, I'm going to punish her." That isn't what it is at all. I think it's a spiritual concept. First of all, let me explain what anonymity is. Because of the nature of my work and what I do, I have been on television a lot and in newspapers a lot. And I'm described as a recovering alcoholic. And people say, "You broke your anonymity." No, I didn't. I am a recovering alcoholic. It's when I mention AA in any way, I can no longer use my name or my face. In 2000, Mary remembers this. A&E Network in America did an hour-long special on Alcoholics Anonymous and had four spokesmen around the country. Just wonderful. And I was the one in my area. And maybe now you remember me. But, you know, once you give your name or your face, you no longer, you can't mention AA. Once you mention AA, you can't show your name or your face. You must not break your anonymity on radio or anywhere else. They used to, in the early days of my sobriety, the 1960s, alcoholism was still kind of an unusual thing. And radio stations would have alcoholics come over and be questioned by their... And I used to go over once in a while, they'd have me come over. I was then known as Alcoholic Al on the air. And one day this guy was talking to me. He said, "Al, do you mean to say that you just parked your car in your garage and put on a hose on the exhaust pipe and committed suicide and actually died and had to be brought back to life to be put into the insane asylum?" He had tears in his eyes. I said, "Sure, I just told him that. Of course I heard it." He said, "Al, you're the first person I've ever seen that's actually tried to kill himself." And I'd been in AA too long by that time. Jeez, I said, "You're the first person I ever met that didn't, you know. What kind of life is it without a suicide now and then?" But anonymity consists of not publicly ever being an AA member or any part of AA. And when you hear people say that, you hear these guys come out of the treatment centers, the Promises in Malibu, movie stars, "I'm a member of AA and I'm doing well." And they get a little article in the paper, they don't do the article next week when they're drunk again, laying face down. They never stay sober. The only movie stars that stay sober are the ones you've never heard of being in AA. There are very few of them. But that's what anonymity is. I think the reason is, it's when we maintain anonymity, it's kind of a curtailment on your ego. It's kind of a spiritual thing. You can't make advantage of it. It's like you're covered by a... What is that thing? Well, I'll take my old freedom. Anyway, but it's like you're underneath a tent and you're protected and you're all there together and you're not violating anything. When you rise above that, when you say, look, as many people have, I'm an AA and I'm a celebrity and people will want to come to AA now. It sounds great, except you're taking yourself out of the tent and you're up here all by yourself. And sooner or later something bad happens because you don't have AA anymore. AA doesn't help you anymore. You helped AA all you can. And it just seems again and again and again I've watched people do that, especially in Hollywood. So I think it's not really any long stretch to say that AA should maintain anonymity. It's a great spiritual concept. So in short, now, I haven't told you much about my story today because we've heard some great talks about the stories from here. But if you're kind of new, I want to explain to you what all these things mean in AA, because your life's going to depend on taking care of them. Today, somebody asked me, why are you wearing a shirt and tie to talk? Why don't you just wear a sports shirt? And the reason is my sponsor, if I did, my sponsor would come out of heaven and kill me. Because he said, I want you to treat AA with respect. Not who cares about what the people in the audience think. Screw them. But when you stand at the podium to the newcomer, you are Alcoholics Anonymous. He doesn't know you're just a slob. You are the spokesman. And you want to look good and sound good. And I believe that to be true. And I, in my home group, which is Los Angeles, now the largest group in the world, about 1,000 people every Wednesday night. Several of you have been to it. The speakers all will wear a shirt and tie. The ladies who speak will wear a dress. People who lead the meeting will wear a shirt and tie or dress. Not everybody goes to the meeting by any means, but we ask them to wear a collared shirt. Treat A with respect. And people seem to flourish under that. We seem to flourish even though it seems we don't like it. But structure brings about success. And so, today we've heard... This morning, the three participants this afternoon, the Alatine and the AA Peter, and it's been good. And the, once again, we all got screwed on the presence of the raffle. But we're in the middle of something better than that. We are in the only organization that has ever been in the history of mankind that helps people of our type of alcoholism. And the greatest battle we have is to remember to be grateful for it and not take it for granted. So I'd say this afternoon, I've come all the way from Los Angeles just to say this. Cherish this. It's the only thing we got. Thank you.
Thanks, Francie. That was fantastic. We had a fantastic day. And I've asked Peter to come and read the promises for us, please, before we close the meeting.
My name's Peter. I'm alcoholic. The AA promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We'll comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We suddenly realise that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialise if we work for them.
Thanks very much.